So welcome. My name is Magdalena Surma. As you all know, I'm Canada's NATO podcast contributor and outreach coordinator here at the NATO Association of Canada. Today, I have the great honor of interviewing Dr. Edward Anthony Koning. He obtained his PhD from Queen's University in 2013 and is currently the assistant professor of political science at the University of Guelph. Dr. Koning, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this interview with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Magdalena.
And Dr. Koning, I'd like to start off by asking you to begin by telling us more about the work that you currently do as the assistant professor at the University of Guelph.
Sure, yeah. So I have basically a full-time position at the University of Guelph in the Department of Political Science. And like many of these jobs, what that means is typically a division of labor that is often referred to as 40-40-20, so 40% of my time I spend on teaching. And so I teach in the politics department, and I teach more specifically courses on research methods, a course on European politics, and then a graduate seminar on social policy. And then besides that, I also do some supervision and direct reading courses as that comes up. Then the other 40% goes to research, and most of my research is about the politics of immigration, specifically in Northwest Europe and North America. And what I'm particularly interested in is what you might call anti-immigrant politics, so both sort of the policies that are being introduced in lots of Western European countries of a restrictive nature affecting immigrants, but also the kinds of politicians who instigate those kinds of policy changes. And then I'm thinking specifically about anti-immigrant parties, parties, or however you want to call them. And so then there is 20% left, and that is dedicated to what we capture with an umbrella term called service. And so here I sit on the graduate committee, reviewing all the files of people who want to apply to our graduate program, or I sit on the committee organizing speaker series events in our department. But there's also more broader, sort of like broader service obligations or responsibilities that come with the job. So that could be, for example, reviewing a journal article for a journal, or reviewing a textbook for a publisher, those kinds of things. So I guess that's the shortest way to summarize my job here.
Yes, and now with the work that you are currently doing, what would you say are some of the most rewarding and challenging aspects associated with teaching students courses in political science?
So I am, as I recently mentioned, responsible for the two methods courses that all students who want to major in political science need to take. So in their third year, they basically need to endure 1 year of me talking to them about how to do social science research, political science research in particular. And I think that those courses are at the same time the most challenging and rewarding when teaching. Because, so for one thing, like I mentioned, it's a compulsory course. So most students are there not by choice, but because they need the credit to get their degree. And on top of that, lots of students are not really sure that taking a course on research methods or on statistics is really going to be of that much benefit to them, let alone that it's going to be very easy. So that's challenging in the sense that you're dealing with a an audience that is not terribly receptive. So on the first day of class, I often start with a joke saying, okay, who of you, by raise of hand, is excited to be here? And then there's usually in a classroom with 150 students, one or two people were nice enough to throw me a bone and raise their hand.
Yeah.
So that's challenging in that sense, but at the same time, it's very rewarding because I think this is a very, very important course. These are very important courses more generally because there's basically, so what I'm trying to get at is that this is not only something that you want to master this material if you want to be a good political scientist, but also if you want to be a good democratic citizen. Because the thing is, there's lots of political information out there, and lots of people comment on politics, you know, public commentators, journalists, politicians themselves, and they use arguments and facts and evidence, but if we don't have the capacity to judge the merits of those kinds of pieces of evidence or facts that they bring forward, then it's very easy to be fooled by others and to be believe things that are simply untrue. And this happens a lot in politics, and I think it's especially now that also there's so much more information available through proliferation of information technology, that this is especially crucial task to master. And I mean, in some ways, this sort of methodological illiteracy has even gone a step further in some political systems. So I don't know if you happen to have seen the interview with Newt Gingrich, who basically said that he doesn't really care about facts and that he's more interested in the feelings of his constituents. So his argument was that his constituents feel that crime is up, and even though crime statistics suggest that crime is down, he doesn't really care about that because he cares more about his feelings. So all in all, what I'm trying to say is that we live in a political climate where there's lots of information coming at us, and that we need to, especially if you're someone who wants to have a degree in political science, you need to be someone who's able to assess the value of information. And so if you're watching the news, you should ask yourself, why is this item on the news and not another item? And why are they interviewing this person and not another person? And what's the evidence they bring forward to support their claims? And is that solid evidence? And might there be a source of bias? Is there competing research that suggests other perspectives? And so sometimes, I wouldn't say for all my students, but every year I feel that there are a number of students who really pick up on this sort of key learning outcome as far as I'm concerned from these courses. And that's very rewarding because sometimes I get emails 1 or 2 years later of students saying, I really enjoyed your course and I noticed that I have practical use of it every day and blah, 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 blah. So that's really rewarding. Supervision and so graduate supervision, when students work on a research project of themselves and I supervise the research project, it's a very different environment. You have students who pick that particular subject because they're interested in it. They approach you to work with you because they want to work with you, and then that's also a very, very fun aspect of my teaching. But I would say that sort of when you especially talk about the relationship between challenging and rewarding, I would definitely refer to my methods course, where many students initially are not too excited, but at the end might see the merits of it, especially in this political climate where there's a lot of information coming at us, and a lot of that information is false, or at least misleading.
And I certainly agree with you, and that's something that I oftentimes advise youth to do and young professionals when studying and examining ongoing world issues, whether it be current news pertaining to international relations, global affairs, or diplomacy. I oftentimes tell students to not limit themselves and to rely on a combination of different sources that are out there. Oftentimes, if you rely on just one source, then not only are you limiting yourself, but again, as you mentioned, there's bias, media bias. You might want to question, why is an individual being interviewed? Why is this news channel covering this specific topic as opposed to others?
It's not only the news, it's also just the fact that the internet is so available.
Yes.
You get the most misleading stuff that you will ever believe. So, for example, one of the most terrible examples that I can think of from the top of my head right now is when the terrorist attack in Paris happened, there quickly started to circulate this video where people were saying, look, this is how people in London, British citizens of Muslim origin, responded to the terrorist attack in Paris. And you see this whole group of mostly Southeast Asian people of Southeast Asian ethnicity cheering very, very enthusiastically. And so people started to get very upset about how it is that people who live in London get excited about terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, that video, 3 weeks later, turned out, was actually taken at the day that I think Pakistan won the World Cup of Cricket.
And so these were just cricket supporters supporting the win of their team and being very excited. So this has nothing to do with the other. And it's very easy to be misled by these things because it's all there and you might be a casual news observer and you might be scrolling through your Facebook and just see that video and think, well, yeah, that is pretty disturbing. Whereas, in fact, it was entirely based on nonsense and lies.
And that's an important point that you bring up because a lot of students and a lot of people that rely on the news, whether it be using internet or reading newspapers or looking at different publications that are out there, oftentimes restrict themselves. So it is important to keep in mind that whenever you are reading a publication, whether it be in the newspaper, whether it be on the internet, or whether it be you listening to an interview, it's so important to critically examine and to question what it is that you're reading. You know, in certain regions of the world, there will be something that happens and it's misinterpreted, it's misrepresented, and with the bias that does exist in the media, I think everyone needs to take into account that obviously it does exist, obviously everyone needs to be aware of it, and when coming up with a decision or when making up your own mind and when getting the facts straight, you have to rely on reliable sources. And I think the best thing to do is to turn to experts, to academics, to scholars, to those who have the expertise and the knowledge to discuss and to disclose information when it comes to certain issues that are presented, whether it be in international relations, global affairs, or diplomacy. I'm always under the impression that academics are the ones that have that knowledge. And that's the one thing that I mainly do is whenever I'm asked about a certain topic, what I do is if I'm knowledgeable in the field, then I will openly discuss that topic. But if I feel that there is an area that is, you know, out of my knowledge, then I won't misrepresent knowing a certain topic. What I will then do is I will advise that individual to reach out to an academic, to reach out to a scholar, to reach out to someone who has the knowledge. So that's another thing to take into account is oftentimes in journalism, you'll come across journalists who will misrepresent facts or are told what to say or will be told how to act. So it is fundamental to examine what it is that you're reading, what it is that you're listening to, and it's fundamental to ask questions. You know, so again, reaching out to academics and reaching out to those who have the knowledge and the expertise is fundamental. And now, Dr. Koning, with your expertise, for those listening to this podcast today, what would you say is the best advice that you can provide to those perhaps who are interested in pursuing a PhD?
I guess my two pieces of advice are, first, you want to, before you embark on this, make very sure that you actually want to do it. And that might not sound like a great sell for a PhD program, but I feel some people dream into a PhD program because they finish their master's degree, they don't really know what to do on the labor market, plus the labor market is pretty tough, so there might not be all that many opportunities. So then they think, well, I'm good at studying, so I'm just going to continue studying. What you need to realize is that a PhD is a pretty onerous process, and depending on your discipline and your exact project, it takes anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7 or 8 years of your life. During that time period, you're not technically employed. You need to rely on funding from others, so there is a lot of uncertainty also about the jobs you can have afterwards. So that's all the bad news that I always want to start with, because I don't think you need to do, you should do a PhD because someone tells you, or because you're not really sure what else to do. So I would say if you are 100% sure that you want to do a PhD, you have enjoyed doing research for your master's and maybe already your undergraduate program, and you have a clear sense of what you want to do with that PhD afterward, then by all means, go ahead and do it. But if you don't know that for sure, I wouldn't even think it's a bad idea to take a year off after your master's, do some work, reflect a little bit more, with a little bit more distance on whether or not a PhD is really the best thing for you. So I realize that's not very optimistic. I thoroughly enjoyed my PhD personally, but I know a lot of people who didn't really enjoy their PhD. I also know, unfortunately, a lot of people who invest a lot of time and money into getting that degree and subsequently are unable to find a job where those qualifications are actually recognized for the use. So that's a